Hello, welcome to the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast. I'm your host, Terrence Lahue. On this show, we grow smarter by learning from the skills and stories, ideas and insights of farmers and agrarians from around the world. Our guest today is Jamie Waldron from JW Butchers and the author of The Home Butchering Handbook. Together, we'll be discussing how he became a butcher, his meat share program, the live classes he hosts, and much, much more. You won't want to miss out on today's episode with Jamie Waldron. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Terrence, thank you for having me.
Now, whenever I meet someone in the butchering and processing industry, I always have to ask, what was it that made you decide to become a butcher?
I wish I had like a really amazing, you know, family lineage story to tell you, but I do not. Unfortunately, it's not that interesting other than the fact I got out of high school and I needed a job. And I had a couple of friends that were working in the town over from me, you know, probably about 20 kilometers away. Sorry, I'm in Canada, so I'll speak in kilometers. and they worked at a very small butcher shop, and just as luck would have it, they needed somebody, and I was a directionless teenager, and I took them up on the opportunity to go and kind of work at the shop. Now, I don't want you to think that I was into, like, cutting meat right off the hop. It was a very kind of, like, very entry-level, so I was just kind of, like, you know, putting the chicken in the counter and just doing menial tasks, cleaning up, that kind of thing, and then it was after that job kind of gave me a bit of like the foundation or at least a foot in the door for a proper butchering job that I took not long after I got that job. And then that's when the butchery kind of really took off for me. So yeah, that was kind of like the origin story, I suppose.
Now, what kind of skills are required for processing an animal? I mean, I imagine most people just think of it as slicing and dicing, but I'm assuming there is definitely far more to it than that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, it took me years and years, and I consider myself to still be a student of the craft because I constantly try to learn and do better every day. But like when you're starting out, like you are such a novice that, I mean, in my situation alone, I didn't touch anything but poultry for about the first 4 years. And then even on my own time, it wasn't even like paid. I was on my own time coming in early to work on pork just because I had a bit of a desire to learn. So on my own time, I would go in early and break down pork loins. And then from there, it just kind of evolved. Once I think that upper management saw that I not only had the passion, but I was developing my skills, then it wasn't until then when they started introducing other cuts to me. So yeah, it wasn't, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. So it's just years and years of muscle memory and just repetition.
How long have you been a butcher now?
So all in total, because I tried like heck to not do it for a number of years, but all in total, I've got about 18 to 19 years in the butchery trade.
Wow, congratulations. You're almost at that 20-year mark.
I'm not entirely sure what the date is to celebrate that anniversary, but I know that it is coming up soon.
Well, that's super cool. Now, when you're processing, going from chickens as the entry-level thing you started out to pork, what were some of the, I'm trying to think of what the best way of phrasing it is, but obviously the animal is different, so it would be processed different. But was it such a large leap, or was it something that there were enough carryover traits from butchering the chickens to the pork that you were able to make the change fairly readily?
I think that the only transferable skills, at least in my mind, is just knife skills. So comfort with a knife, ability to kind of use that comfort to your advantage to make sure that you are making the cuts properly. But honestly, like I just observed for the longest time, and then maybe I would have someone kind of like coach me through it so that I wasn't doing too bad of a job. But the anatomy on a bird and then moving into a quadruped is just like night and day. So the only transferable skills in my mind are just knife skills. So if you've got the skills and are comfortable with a knife, then, I mean, you're probably about, I don't know, somebody will probably shoot me for saying this, but probably about 80% of the way there. After that, it's just kind of having a mentor or someone at least to kind of coach you through the proper steps when you move up that chain of command from poultry and then onto, yeah, four-legged beasts.
So then, as far as four-legged beasts are concerned, does that mean from a pig to a cattle is a fairly similar process?
I would liken moving, the transition for me, I found easier going from pork into lamb, and then lamb, just because of the way that the muscles are kind of structured, it's just almost like a miniature version of beef. So okay. I found that transition going to lamb to beef to be a lot more beneficial for me.
Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting because really it is an escalation in complexity. And there's so much there. And from personal experience, I can say I've definitely seen where my family would buy like a whole cow and then have a local processor butcher it. And we worked with the most wonderful butcher for a number of years. And then we moved and they went to a new butcher. And when the meat came back, I started wanting to weep as I looked at this meat just hunked and chunked into pieces instead of the graceful cuts that I was used to.
Yeah.
I mean, the butchering process really does have a dramatic difference on how the cut not just looks aesthetically, but also how it can taste.
Absolutely. I feel like, you know what, there's such, oh man, I don't know, I feel like this is, yeah, just could just like blow the top off of this conversation, but I mean, it is so true. When you go from even just like one butcher shop to the next, I mean, I guess the change could be even more drastic from saying like a grocery store to a butcher shop where you're getting pretty much just box meat and someone's just portioning out steaks, and then you go into more of an independent butcher shop where they're actually bringing in whole carcasses. Like, just the skill set and what's happening on those two day-to-day operations are, again, night and day. Outside of just selling beef, they're just two totally different sorts of operations. So, yeah, it's funny, though, because I hear that story a lot of, like, just the comfort of going to the same place day in and day out for years and years, and then all of a sudden something changes, a new owner takes over, people move, and then it's almost like they have to start over from square one. So, yeah, it can be a very frustrating experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, when you're processing an animal, are you looking at because I know that, based from my experience, I know that you can kind of give a list of this is kind of what I'm looking for from it. But when you're processing an animal, are you specifically trying to target a certain number of, say, steaks or roasts or loin pieces? Or are you kind of working with the animal and how it best processes out so there's a minimal amount of waste afterwards?
That's a great question. It is very circumstantial to what kind of the day presents itself as. So in my situation, because I'm doing meat shares out of whole carcasses, I have to be kind of, cognizant of the fact that I need to utilize that carcass as best as possible. So in prior jobs, I may have been just doing pretty much a standardizing. So every animal was being broke down the same day in and day out, week after week. But this meat share program has kind of opened my eyes to utilizing the carcass as best as possible, because it's more about providing my customers with all the opportunities out of the carcass instead of just maybe a more standardized cut sheet that people are used to getting from, like, say, an abattoir or a cut plant where you buy a side of beef and you know that you're going to get, and oh my, maybe way too much ground beef. In my mind, too much ground beef and stew meat, where those muscles maybe aren't being utilized as best as possible. But in my situation, because I'm always trying to coax full muscles out that can be used, it's different all the time. So it is very circumstantial. So I think it's just, you know, you have to kind of have those conversations with your clientele, and then maybe they're a little bit more keen on, you know, or a home cook that might be a little bit more keen on utilizing some of those underutilized muscles or cuts that maybe the wider audience isn't aware of. But you have to be kind of on top of that so that you can coax those muscles out too. So I think that might answer your question, or maybe I've gone off topic way. But you just have to kind of hook me back in sometimes, Terrence, because I do tend to kind of veer off subject.
No,
sometimes.
That's perfectly fine. That's why we're called the intellectual agrarian. I mean, I think that some of our best conversations come from rabbit trails, but you brought up a really good point that I wanted to ask. So this meat share program, what made you decide to start it?
I think if you've done any type of looking into small businesses, one of the first questions that you're supposed to answer is there a need and how can you fill that need? So I recognized a need within these meat shares because of what we were just talking about. And that was people going in, maybe finding a farmer that they either know or have been turned on to from somebody else. And then that farmer is only going to be selling whole, half, or quarters. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of meat for people. It's like one of the big things I hear from my customers is like, I don't have a chest freezer. I've got a refrigerator freezer, or maybe I've got something small that can handle, you know, not so much. So you eliminate so much of the population by just saying, oh, I'm sorry, I'm either going to sell you a whole, half, or a quarter. Like, that's a lot of meat. I mean, it is an absurd amount of meat. And for those people that can do that and can bring that type of meat into their home and properly store it, hats off to you. But that's not a large portion of the population, at least in more urban settings anyway. So I saw a need for someone to work with these farmers, totally vet them. So that's what I kind of do. I go out to the farms, I meet them, I talk to them, I get a better understanding of how they're raising their animals, where they're being harvested and slaughtered, and then I can go from there and go, you know what, I really want to work with this farm. So then I have gathered this kind of stable, pardon the impression, and so I've got these farmers that I work with, and they let me know when they have animals that are coming ready. So for instance, I've got a side of grass-fed beef that's coming up in a few weeks. It's already hanging, but this is a wonderful farm. Their animals are outside on pasture year-round, even through the Canadian winters. And so I found 8 people to put on this beef. So these people are not on the hook for an absurd amount of absurd amount of beef. They're all going to walk away with 20 pounds of meat. And then there's lots of bones that go around afterwards, too. So I make them into a very manageable amount of meat that the person with the home freezer, not the big chest freezer, can certainly store that meat, and it will keep them fed for weeks, if not months, depending on their kind of eating habits. But so I saw a need for people that wanted this pasture-raised meat, this ethically raised meat, but didn't have the means to either store or even afford it, for that matter, because it is such a large sum of money when you're shelling out for that much meat. It is. So like 20 pounds of pork, 20 pounds of beef, a half a lamb, or I do like four chickens in what I call a chicken share. So, and they're broke down to however the people want them. So it's kind of a method of buying bulk. But the savings are substantial, and I think that it's for the flexible cook that, you know, in a pork share, for instance, you're going to get sausages and ground pork and some bacon, but you know what, you're also going to see a pork hock, and you're also going to see some side ribs, and you might even see a jowl. So being flexible in your approach is certainly one of the kind of the attributes that I'm looking for in these customers as well. But I mean, yeah, again, when all is said and done, not everyone has enough space to store a half a beef. So I'm providing an opportunity for people to have pasture-raised meat in a 20-pound meat share instead of all this meat that they can't store.
How long does the 20 pounds usually last the average customer?
That's a good question. Again, depending on their kind of like meat eating habits, I have people generally repeating, if not monthly, bi-monthly, especially when it comes to pork. Now, beef, people seem to eat a little bit quicker, and chicken, of course, is one of the most popular meats in North America, so people tend to blow through those 4 chickens. So they're generally monthly for the chicken. So yeah, it all just really depends on how much meat they're eating. So, and again, because this is, I mean, I'm not kind of appealing to the crowd that buys meat and eats it probably 3 times a day. These are people that kind of see meat as more of something to be celebrated. So maybe it's a once a day, maybe 2 times a day max thing. So they generally kind of stretch it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, that's one of those interesting things that I have a marketing background. I always love to see how the marketing process of this works. And really so much of it is, who are the customers you're targeting? How can you best appeal to their specific needs? And especially in this case, you've addressed a problem that a lot of urban people have, which is, yeah, they're not going to buy a chest freezer to put in their condo or apartment or suburban home because they don't need it. And they aren't going to consume that much meat probably within a given year anyway.
That's right.
Now,
that's
when
right.
the...
Yeah.
2 questions I have. 1, with the chickens, are they getting them whole or in pieces?
So the share is just kind of laid out just as a basic guideline. I leave 2 chickens whole, and then the other 2 I break down into wings, legs, boneless skin on breast, and then they get the carcasses to make their stock. So, but again, I'm really flexible in this. Like I encourage people to, you know, email me and say, you know what, I just want them all whole, or you know what, bone them all out and I'll take all the bones. So, I mean, again, I'm just kind of flexible in that way. So,
well, and that's really nice because it does allow the people to feel more in control of their own food. I think that so much of I always feel bad when I start a sentence with "I think," but so much of what we see in today's day and age is we've kind of lost agency with our food in many cases. We just buy whatever is prepackaged in the grocery store or whatever we get at the farmer's market instead of having some degree of autonomy or choice over this is how I want the meat to be. This is what I would like. And especially with chicken, it's one of those things that's nice to be able to have those options because sometimes you're a person that you like having just the whole bird and you like to do that process yourself. And then there's also a lot of other people that say, oh, please, I don't want to touch that thing any more than I have to. Please just have it all pre-ready for me.
And you know what? That brings up a great point, too. It was another kind of experience that I've had through conversations with others who have bought sides of beef or, you know, half a pig or whatever, and they go to the abattoir, and this isn't me slinging mud, that's not the point of this, but the point that I was seeing is that these people were so limited in what was available to them, and for many reasons, abattoirs and custom cut plants operate this way.
Could you define what an abattoir is?
So an abattoir, I guess, is, our term in Canada for a kill plant. So okay. A place where the animals go and are harvested and then maybe further processed after that.
Thank you.
No problem. So, so a lot of these kill plants and custom cut facilities were just kind of like, they'll give you like a Xerox sheet where it's like, okay, I need you to check that you want, you know, X amount of boneless chops, X amount of sausage, and X amount of bacon. And honestly, like, they're given so few options. And again, this is just one of those things that I kind of saw in my business was I thought, you know what is might be a different approach to these people, again, to give them more agency over their food. We can have a conversation, whether that be through email, or I'm happy to go and have a coffee with them, or, hey, a glass of wine or something, and with a pen and paper, and I want to have a conversation with them, and I want them to tell me what they want, because I'm not processing 500 hogs a week. I'm literally buying, you know, a few pigs a week, and I want to cut them to spec for the customer. So I want to have that conversation so that they can say, you know what, I am totally wild about this one sausage recipe. Can you make that for me? Sure, no problem. How much do you want? I'm going to need this many pounds. Okay, well, cause and effect means that we may have to sacrifice some other cuts to accommodate that, but we'll have that conversation and we'll talk about it and we'll see what do you want to get out of this? Not just here's X, Y, and Z options, you know, take it or leave it kind of thing. It's no, I want them to have a little bit more, you know, autonomy with their food for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm genuinely curious, how often do you have people that say, I want the entire pig and bacon?
That is such a funny question because I have had that, but it's only happened a couple times. And I think that
Thank goodness. People
who generally kind of stumble upon my website are hopefully not under the impression that that can happen again because they are done in meat shares. Like, mm-hmm. I'm very upfront with people that say, like, I'm sorry, yes, it's 20 pounds of meat, but, you know, I can't give you 20 pounds of pork tenderloin. That doesn't exist. I can't give you 20 pounds of pork chops. Like, there's seven other people that need part of this animal, too. So anyway, long story short is it hasn't happened very often, but it has happened.
Well, and again, I think that that's the cool thing about what you're doing is because you really are allowing people to have a choice and a decision on how their food, you give them a greater understanding of the different cuts that are available. And I think that's really neat in how your meat share program works.
Thanks. Yeah. And I think that, you know, again, like, and if they're stuck for stuff, like it wasn't like a day or two after my last pork share, like someone emailed me and was like, and their questions were, okay, great. Loved it. We had the pork chops last night. Amazing pork. But what do I do with the belly? What do I do with the hock? And what do I do with, I can't remember what the last one was. I think it was this jowl that I have. So it's like, that's great. I mean, I'm flattered that they would actually reach out to me because a lot of people would just see this and go, I can't do anything with this. And then they would never come back to me. But I hope that they see value in the fact that I'm approachable. They can email me. I will gladly pass around some recipes that I've found to be very helpful over the years. And we can have those conversations again. So honestly, it's just, I just want to, like, these people to, like, welcome me into their lives as some sort of reference point, not just a meat slinger that is getting them, you know, T-bones at a really ridiculously low price. Like, I want to have a different relationship with my customers.
Mm-hmm. So how much of, as a butcher, how much of a cooking and chef skills have you had to develop as a butcher? Because I would assume that there's a little bit of correlation between you need to know how this piece is going to be cooked or could be cooked.
That's a great question. So, like, when I first started, I was introduced immediately to just some very basic things, like chicken stock. And I know how that silly that sounds. Like, oh, well, what do you mean you don't know how to make chicken stock? Well, honestly, at the age of 19, I had no idea. I didn't know up or down. I mean, honestly, meat was not a focal point in my life at that point. So
yeah,
just learning the very basics of stock making. And then it wasn't until really that I took a job and convinced my wife to move with me to just outside the Hamilton area, which we are right now. And I took a job at a butcher shop called Cumbres. And Cumbres has full commercial kitchens in each one of their now three butcher shops, soon to be four. And in those kitchens, they're making all of the beef stocks. They're making all of the chicken stocks. They're making lasagnas and pies and all these other things. So they employ some wonderful chefs, and I've got to meet a few of them, and I really got to kind of immerse myself in their world and just the knowledge that I was able to kind of draw from them. So that has stuck with me because me as a butcher, as a frontline person, especially in a retail operation, we were very approachable to the customers. Like, we're there. There's literally a counter that separates us. And it was a daily basis, multiple times. How do I cook this? What should I do with this? What's the best way to do this? You know, like, and those conversations, like, were invaluable because if I didn't know, there was always chefs around that I could always kind of like say, hey, can you come down here and have a conversation with this person? And then just sit there and listen to their conversation and absorb what they had to say. So, my job is certainly not to be a chef, but I think it's an invaluable skill to be able to at least translate the basics. And I don't pretend to be a chef, and I'm happy to rope anybody else into the conversation that I feel has more to offer to the conversation than just me kind of like talking, you know, out of both sides of my mouth in order to kind of make a sale or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had made a comment earlier about you have right now a grass-fed beef hanging. How long do you let meat hang, or how long do you like to let beef hang before you process it?
So the grass-fed beef, generally about 3 weeks, has been yielding some really nice results, so I'm happy to do 3 weeks on the grass-fed. If I'm doing something with a little bit of grain finish, I can push it a little bit longer. It just tends to have a bit more fat covering. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, about 4 weeks on the grain finished, but when I'm dealing with grass-fed, 3 weeks. Pork, I'll let go for 5 to 7 days. I find that it really kind of dries out nicely, and it becomes a lot more firmer product, which is really nice. And lamb, about the same as pork, about five to seven days on lamb. And that's just kind of some very general guidelines that I work with.
Yeah. Now, you've also started teaching people the process of butchering. How did that come about? Is teaching something you've always had a natural interest in, or what's the story here?
Not at all. Honestly, Terrence, I've had some opportunities fall in my lap that, you know, I should just, I don't know, thank the universe or whoever, but I've been very fortunate with opportunities that just kind of come to me. And I think that it's because I have a natural ability to be able to talk in front of groups. I don't have to envision anybody without clothes on or really
thank
psych
goodness.
Myself up for it. Yeah, exactly. Tell me about it. That saves me a lot of anxiety. So, no, I'm able to just have a comfortable disposition in front of people. So, it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago that a now friend opened up a restaurant in the town that we were living in. And I had been reading about people doing these, like, dinners where they would break down a pig in front of the diners, and then the chef would make a menu out of it. And I thought that was just the coolest thing. And so this friend opened up this restaurant at a like white linen fine dining restaurant, and I said, hey, what do you think about this? And he said, absolutely, let's try it out. So here I am in the middle of this fine dining restaurant breaking down a pig in front of guests, and it was a great experience, not only for me but for the diners, and the chefs loved it because they got this whole side of pork that they could just like have like full autonomy just to play around and make new dishes that they don't normally get to. So it was a really, really positive experience. And then outside of that, like talking to some of the guests, it was like, wow, that was really neat to see you do that. Like that would be such a cool thing to be able to learn how to do, or at least experience it. So that got my wheels turning. And then I just kind of started to look around and feel out like, what are some opportunities to maybe dabble in this teaching thing? And it wasn't too long before I got turned on to an organization in another town that would be just outside of Toronto, and we reference outside of Toronto as the GTA, and I don't know what the mile or kilometer radius is from the downtown Toronto, but the GTA encompasses all sorts of different towns and small cities. So it was in Guelph, which is about an hour, maybe about a half hour to an hour outside of Hamilton. In Guelph, there's an organization called Minga. And they were a skill building hub is what they built themselves as. And they were just running classes in maybe at the time, maybe like bread making, beekeeping, so on and so forth, building a community through shared skills. So I approached them and they thought it was like just the greatest thing ever. And we started launching classes and then one thing led to another. And 7 years later, I am teaching, sometimes 8 times a month, sometimes... Wow. You know, less, sometimes more, depending. And I travel all over Ontario and teach these skills. And, you know, I think it kind of has something to do with the fact that I might be one of the only butchers out there with a website. So I'm pretty easy to find. And I've had emails, Terrence, around the globe. And that's not me jumping up on a soapbox. That literally is a fact that I've had, like, especially from the States, from Ireland, of people saying, hey, can you come over here and run a class? And I'm like, it's going to take a little bit more than that for me to come to Ireland to teach a class with 8 people on one pig. Like, it may not make sense. But and we can talk about other weird and interesting emails that I've got through that. But anyway, so I digress. But I've been doing it now for about 6 or 7 years, and it's taken off. I teach all over Ontario. It doesn't seem to be slowing down in the slightest for the amount of people that are interested in doing it. And I know that there's other people that do it in North America. You have some amazing people teaching classes. Farmstead Meatsmith, I know you've had Brandon on the show. Mm-hmm. Like, his is just awesome. I would love to go take it. But I know that there's a lot of other people that are teaching them. And it's just become this really kind of like popular thing. And people are just really psyched up about having that connection with their food. I think it's great.
So can you kind of walk us through what one of these classes looks like?
Sure. Like, pork seems to be the most popular for, I'm sure, a variety of reasons. A, affordability, and B, just the fact that it's a larger animal and people kind of feel like they get to play butcher for 3 hours. So we get 8 people in a class for a whole animal, and I split the group up 4 and 4. And then we just walk through on a rotational basis, taking the animal down into its primal. So we take the head off, and then we take the leg off, and then we take the shoulder, and we separate the belly from the loin. And then they're all kind of turned over onto their own pieces independently to work on those through my guidance. And for the next 3 hours, they're just kind of coached in a step-by-step basis on the pieces that they're working on. And then at the end of it, everybody cleans up. We wrap everything up, label it, and everybody goes home with 1/8 of the pig. So to circle back to the meat shares, they're almost kind of like working for their meat shares. They go home with their 1/8 of a nose-to-tail experience of roughly 20, 25 pounds of meat at the end of the class.
Wow. Again, I just think that's really awesome. Have you noticed any, is there a stereotype of the people that take your classes, but have you noticed any general themes in the people that are interested in the course?
I wish I could. Honestly, no, it is all walks. I can paint with a broad brush with the people that come through. So for instance, last night I taught one and I had a commercial hog farmer that raises about, I would say probably 6,000 hogs a year in cycles that goes into the commodity market. He wanted a better understanding of how his pigs get taken apart. A couple was moving out to Nova Scotia from the GTA this coming weekend, and they plan on raising commercial hogs again. So that was kind of a new thing to me to have 3 commercial hog farmers there. There was a barbecue enthusiast. There was a couple guys that always meet for a birthday experience, a shared birthday experience. So they were there. And then the last one was a caterer who just, again, wanted a little bit more connection with the food and understand how the animal kind of supplies the different pieces that he searches out for his catering. So, and then on top of that, honestly, Terrence, it's like homesteaders, you know, people that are just kind of like looking after their own homes and managing like the food that comes in and out the door. So there's like the people that are looking after the home economics of their own homes. Oh man, honestly, like I've had vegetarians take the class because they are considering eating meat, and this to them is an education in not only how to break apart an animal, maybe cost savings, but then just to have that reassurance that they know that the animal has been raised in a caring manner, has been raised ethically, and has been slaughtered in a way that they can now kind of like wrap their heads around in order to reintroduce meat into their diets.
That is so cool. I love the fact that food, especially, it's such a unifying force that it gives it means there's such an opportunity for, no matter who you are, where you're at, to learn and understand it and not feel necessarily like an outsider, because it's we're all different. We're all in this field doing something, and that's what I love about it. One of the many things I love about it.
Me too. I think it's fantastic. Like, it's such a great experience. And now, oh boy, yeah. On that topic of those classes, like, I just kind of look at it from, you know, I was often kind of like shaking my head, like, wow, what's the deal with this pork? Like, everybody wants to take these pork classes, and I get it. Like, it's, you know, it's a bigger animal. They get to, again, play butcher for a day. But I've always just been a bigger fan, and I wish more people would just take the chicken class. And I think that this is just kind of like now my opportunity to get up on a soapbox and kind of preach that message, because, like, I just look at it like, my outlook is like, I know that about 5% of these people will ever go home and maybe get another side of pork and try to get through it again. There's a lot of information to kind of take in. It's not rocket science. You can certainly learn it. It's, yeah, again, it's not the hardest thing in the world to do, but again, bringing in a whole side of pork into your home kitchen to do it, probably not going to happen. So I have to show it from the rooftops that I just think that, like, take a chicken class. That's where the real kind of, like, win is in my book. Like, everyone can generally afford a whole chicken, even if it's a pasture chicken. It might be a little bit more expensive, but the savings in buying a whole pasture chicken for $20-$25 and then breaking it down and having that knowledge and just kind of like get everything that you can out of a chicken, that's where the win is. That's where the savings are in my mind. So anyway, sorry. Yes, I totally agree with you on that.
I used to sell whole chickens at a farmer's market, and obviously they had already been processed to the point where they were just the whole chicken. But even at that, there were so many people that didn't know what to do with a whole chicken. Even after it had been processed and it's wrapped, they're like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, well, you can either cook it whole or you can cut it yourself. And just this expression of confusion, not to belittle my customers, they were wonderful people, but this expression of confusion that would be very visible on their faces was a little sad in some ways, and I did my best to offer what advice I could, but heck, I barely cut chickens myself. I have been very blessed to have wonderful people in my life that do most of the cooking in that manner, so I haven't had to. But it's, again, one of those, it's a good skill to have. And transitioning our conversation here into learning those skills, you've actually written a book called The Home Butchering Handbook. How did that book come about?
Okay, so this is another one of those things. Like, I'm telling you, like, I've just been so fortunate that... So a little backstory to the book, just as a lead-in to put a little bit of context around it. So my wife and I moved back to the area that we're originally from, outside of Windsor, Ontario, which is across the river from Detroit. So south of Windsor, about a half hour, is a little town called Kingsville. And my wife and I had an opportunity to partner up with some people to open up a butcher shop. We did. We had a really bad partnership, not the way that we wanted it to end, but it did. And then we were kind of stuck in this area and wondering what we're going to do. So I begrudgingly took a job, again, knowing some people in the business down there, I begrudgingly took a job at a pork kill plant. And I'd never really worked in that kind of like situation, like on a day-to-day basis. I had worked in some kill plants, but it wasn't anything that I did a steady job. So here I am. Now I'm in a pork abattoir doing, you know, 150 to 200 hogs a day. I'm thinking it's not exactly the high point in my life. With 2020 vision, looking back in retrospect, I think that it was invaluable, and I'm glad that I worked there for the 6 to 8 months. But be that as it may, so I'm on break at this job, and I'm not feeling too good about myself, but I get a random message through, I think, Twitter or something like that, from a book editor that says, hey, we're looking for somebody that has teaching experience to write a book on home butchering. Would you be interested? And I just kind of went, that is one of the more stranger messages I've got. And so I immediately reached out and said, yes, how do I make this happen? So it was just, and then it was a snowball from there. So I had a conversation with the gentleman, Brooke Farling, at Penguin Alpha at the time, and we talked about it. And it was something, honestly, it wasn't the most difficult thing to put together. I co-wrote it with a woman that lives in the States who had written some books before, and we just went through and did a very detailed kind of like step-by-step instruction on breaking down beef, pork, lamb, chicken. There's some fish in there. There's sausage making. There's a little bit of curing and smoking. So it covers a lot of bases. And I just kind of roped in some friends that I had to help me out with some of the aspects of the book that I wasn't too familiar with, just to make sure that we had some legitimate information. And then, that's how the book came about. And again, this is one of those situations where it's just like, hey, I'm sure that when the search was happening online, it was butcher, education, and those two hits probably yielded maybe about one butcher that came back. And again, me having a website or a Twitter account has just kind of opened up that door to allow that to happen. So yeah, it was pretty wild turn of events.
That's really awesome. Now let's say that there's a farmer or a homesteader, even just a customer at home, that's listening to our conversation right now and decides they want to take a little bit more agency and they want to learn more about this process. What are some resources? Obviously, your book, The Home Butcher's Handbook, but what are some other resources or places you'd suggest they look to learn more about this process?
Well, one of the kind of the no-brainers is going onto YouTube, and there's no shortage of videos on there. So Bon Appetit has put together probably some of the most thorough videos that I've seen, just multi-angle. They've invested some money in it. They brought in some really good quality people. I think Brian Mayer is a friend of mine, does a side of pork. And they've got a guy from Fleischer's in New York. He breaks down a side of beef. He just does a wonderful job. I know his Instagram handle is Criminal Defense Butcher, and I can't think of his name. Oh, my God. Jeremy, I believe. So anyway, he does a side of beef. Those are just great videos. And then outside of that, if you can kind of retain the knowledge through reading, there's just some fantastic books out there that have been published. Adam Danforth has some really thorough looks at things. The Applestones, who opened Fleischer's originally, they've got a great book on butchering at home. Ryan Farr, 4505 Meats, down in San Francisco. His book is beautiful. I can't say enough about that. And then, yeah, I think those are some great resources. I don't think anybody's listening to podcasts in order to learn how to break down a chicken, Terrence, but I would certainly steer them on to yours if that was the case. But no, I think those resources, just off the top of my head, are really good starting points for people, and I think that they can really certainly take a deep dive off there and just they'll spider web from there, and you'll find so many other resources that are available to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, as we kind of wrap up here, are there like new cuts that come out? I mean, obviously, the composition of the animal really doesn't change, but
yeah,
as time goes on, are there like new ways of cutting the animal to make new pieces of meat, or is it these are the cuts of meat that exist? This is the defined limit of what can be cut out of an animal, and that's all there ever will be.
That's an interesting question, because when I came up through the ranks, working with some of the old school guys that have been doing it for a while, and I was very fortunate to be working in situations where they were bringing in whole carcasses, and while I didn't necessarily have the opportunity to work on beef when I was a young kid, I got to learn a lot. And those guys were breaking down beef drastically different than I would approach it now. And even now, you'll hear some people say, like, looking for different roasts that you don't normally see retailed. So like, if you see like a cross Bros. That sounds really familiar, and people have heard of it, but you don't really see it very often anymore. So there's like a changing of the tide, I guess, coming in with these new cuts, and chefs are always influencing things. But listen, the beef and pork and lamb world, like the higher powers, the councils that kind of regulate, you know, maybe some of the more commercial operations, cattlemen's associations, in Canada, we would have the Canada Pork that oversee the more marketing agencies. They're always looking to utilize the carcass in different ways. So, for instance, Canada Pork is really kind of getting excited about Japanese cuts. So they're utilizing muscles and maybe slicing them thinner to do like shabu shabu or something like that. Oh. So while the muscle structure is the same, it's different fabrication methods that are coaxing different cuts out to kind of keep it interesting for customers or giving retailers more options to sell more product. For instance, in the beef world, you never really heard about the Denver. It's a really popular cut now, or the Merlot that comes out of the beef heel. Again, another popular cut that you hear about now that you would have never heard about 5-10 years ago. So there's always people, really innovative people, that are looking for different ways to merchandise these carcasses in order to keep things fresh. And in the process, they're finding really interesting cuts. Like this Merlot cut is found in the heel of the beef that you would think would just be the toughest muscle on the animal. But
yeah,
when you know it, this Merlot cut is extremely tender. So like people are just dissecting and you know, exploring. And it's a really kind of exciting time to be a part of the industry.
Do you have a favorite cut?
That's circumstantial. I liken it to the person that says, you know, their favorite beer was a Corona, but of course it was on the beach in Mexico, right? And then they have a Corona when the dead of winter in Toronto, and it's not exactly what they're looking for. So for me, it's very circumstantial and seasonal. So right now, my wife, she just does some amazing cooking at home. When she wants a blade roast, so we'll get a blade roast, or we'll, you know, dig one out of the freezer that's been in there since, you know, maybe a little too long, but anyway, so dig a blade roast out, and she'll prepare that. And this time of year where it's cold and snowy and just ugly outside, that blade roast is fantastic. But then we get into the summertime, and I'm just looking for a really high-quality pork chop to put on the grill, or a really nice kind of aged ribeye or bone-in rib steak. Like, that's... those are kind of my things. And again, I just kind of find it circumstantial based on seasons.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
So I've got a website where I list all my workshops and dates for meat share pickups. It's at jwaldronbutchers.com. And if you go to Instagram and just search out J Waldron Butchers on Instagram, you'd find me. On Facebook, you'll find me. And those seem to be about the three easiest ways to find me. Yeah, and a YouTube search, I'm sure, would probably yield some results too. If you really want to look at my face, that's your, I'll leave that to you. But those other avenues are super easy to find me and see what I'm up to.
Thank you again for joining us on the show.
Terrence, it was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Big thanks to Jamie for joining us on the show today. You can learn more about him and his work by going to jwaldronbutchers.com and by following him on Instagram. All of this and more you can find linked in the show notes at intellectualagrarian.com/Waldron. If you're new to the show, please subscribe on whatever your podcast player of choice is. While you are there, please leave us a rating and review, letting others know how great the show is. Tips on how to do this can be found at intellectualagrarian.com/review. Thanks again for listening. This has been Terrence Lahue and the Intellectual Agrarian Podcast, reminding you to keep farming the dream.